our speaker is Trish. She is from the Expect a Miracle group in Lansdale.
I thought that was going to take a lot longer. I was going to have less time to speak. But hi, everybody. My name is Trish. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really loud, so I hope I don't blow everybody's eardrums. I don't usually have a microphone in front of me. But I don't know what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. If I stumble, I'm really sorry. I'm, like, super nervous. I'm, like, shaking up here. But Dave told me that's okay because God's taking the truth out of me. So we'll see what happens. If it sucks, then we'll wait him. My sobriety date is January 4th, 2007. My mom, actually, the last time I spoke, she showed up and really made me nervous, and I said the wrong sobriety date twice in one meeting. So I got it right this time. Good start. From the beginning, I'm one of six kids, Irish Catholic. It seems like everybody in AA is Irish Catholic. I have two parents, still married to this day, really like loving, strangely functional family, which in the beginning I actually was pretty upset about that because I wanted one of those like horror stories that other people had, you know, about like abuse and neglect and all that stuff, because then I would have an excuse, you know. But because I don't have that, I have no excuse for my actions or the things that happen. Everything was a direct result of me and my choices. But, you know, my story isn't anything, like, super interesting, so, but it's definitely the saddest story that I know, because I'm the one that had to live it, and I had to feel everything. So, I'm really close with all my brothers and sisters. I'm the only one that is an alcoholic or an addict of any sort. I think that some of them might be in here one day, but I guess I can't make that decision. I started drinking when I was like 12. I was down at the shore, down in Wildwood, and my sister let me drink Miller Lite, and I got drunk, so she put me to bed. And I was like lying in bed, and I like really wanted more. You know, like I was just laying there, and I was just kind of thinking about it. So I got up, and I went downstairs, and I got some more. And then I went back upstairs so I wouldn't get caught. And I was laying there, and I really wanted more. So I went to sneak back downstairs, and on the way, I fell into the hall closet and woke everybody up. And I got in trouble. So, but to me, that just kind of shows that, like, that was there from the first time that I picked up. Like, I had that craving and that obsession, you know. But at the time, it didn't mean anything to me. I didn't even know. Anyway, so I got caught, and I got grounded for, like, 2 months. And, I kind of drank, like, off and on, you know, from that point until I was 15. Like, at family parties, I'd dump out a soda can and I'd fill it with beer or, you know, that type of stuff. But nothing. Am I too loud? Because I feel like I'm crazy loud. Anyway, and then it wasn't until I was 15 that I started drinking daily. And I was 15, and I met a boy, and he was 21. And he had a car, and he could buy me cigarettes, and he could buy me beer. And so I was in love, because what else is a 15-year-old girl looking for? And he drank every day, and therefore I drank every day. And that was okay, because that's kind of what I wanted anyway. And when I was 16, it seemed like every time I drank, I would black out. And because I was drinking every day, I was blacking out a lot. Between 16 and 20, like, everything's like a strobe light. You know, like, I really don't remember much. Most of the stories that I know that, like, I did, like, my war stories or whatever, they're all things that other people told me. I don't remember any of it. But, which is kind of sad. But on the other hand, like, thank God I don't remember it for myself. But, so when I was 16, I was a pretty honest person, like, up until that point. Like, that's really the part that I started lying at, because I got caught drinking one night. My parents called me, and they were like, you got to come home. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. So, I don't know, somehow I got dropped off, and my mom found me passed out in the front lawn with a cigarette in my hand, and, like, I had peed myself, because that's when that started. And And when I first mentioned that at an AA meeting, this girl turned to me, she's like, oh my God, aren't you embarrassed to say that? I was like, well, I don't do it anymore. So it's okay, you know. But anyway, so she found me pissed outside, and I had just gotten off punishment from getting caught again. And you might worry, like, I got caught doing everything. Everything. And I used to think that that was like, that I was so unlucky. But now looking back at it on hindsight, I'm really lucky because it was all those consequences that pushed me in here so young. But, so anyway, the next day when I sobered up, my parents asked me why I kept drinking the way that I was. And I was honest. I said that I get really depressed when I don't drink and I shake. And I thought that meant, well, if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, then you would just push it all towards me and say, oh, you feel like that? Go ahead. You know, go ahead and drink. And that's not what happened. They sent me to rehab, outpatient in Livingren. And so apparently when you tell the truth, it doesn't work well for you. So I just started lying. And when I got in there, I told the therapist, like, you know, I only drink like once every like 2 weeks and it's nothing out of control. And so I was only in there for about 6 months, and I just did outpatient, you know, therapy, which actually probably made it worse because I met a bunch of kids in there that did a whole lot worse stuff than I did, and I thought that was really cool. So then I wanted to do all that stuff. But by the grace of God, I didn't. I got out of that, and I kept drinking, and then I turned 17, and, you know, not only was I blacking out every day and drinking every day, but now I was, like, peeing myself all the time, you know, like, and like I said, I don't do it anymore, so it's really not a big deal. But I graduated high school, and then by the time I turned 18, that's when I started to get arrested. It seemed like I got arrested like every like 4 months or something. My claim to fame was at Temple. I moved into my dorm, and I was there for 3 hours, and then I got arrested. And apparently Temple isn't the best neighborhood down in North Philly, and the cop found me at like 2 o'clock in the morning wandering around on like 11th and Oxford. And so they picked me up and they brought me to the hospital because my BAC was like a 3.5, and so they like didn't even bring me to jail. They brought me right to the hospital, which was nice because it's the hospital that my mom worked at. And I had just remembered, like, waking up, you know, and having all these tubes in me. And someone before I went to college said, if you ever get caught in a hospital, just leave because they can't keep you there. And I was like, okay. So I woke up and I saw these tubes and I just ripped them out and I started walking down the hall. And then I got tackled. And they, like, put me up again. So eventually I got out of there and I went back to my dorm and I was trying to, like, recover. And all my roommates came back and I'm like, oh my God, Trish, you're famous. And I was like, what are you talking about? And apparently Bill Cosby goes to Temple, you know, for like whenever the new students come in and then whenever they graduate. And he was giving a speech, you know, you got to be careful, good luck. You know, you ladies, you got to be careful. You can't end up like the drunk girl last night did. And that was me. I was really excited. So that was my claim to fame. But I wasn't even really upset about getting arrested because I thought that was cool. You know, a couple months later, I got arrested again with another underage. And, you know, that was a fun story to tell again. And then a couple months after that, I got arrested again for another underage. And then it was just kind of sad. And then I got arrested again for another age another 4 months after that. And then it was just kind of getting ridiculous because I had a lot of fines to pay and couldn't drive. So in that span, I ended up getting 6 underages and 2 DUIs between 18 and 20. And you know, which sometimes when I hear people in meetings tell their stories and how, you know, they lived under bridges and, you know, were like robbing people and all this stuff, like I would think that like that wasn't bad. But like I have to compare myself to me and like for me that was bad, you know. I still don't have my license back. It's been 3 years of sobriety if they don't trust me. But so my first DUI, I was up in this area. I wanted to be the cool older sister, and my 16-year-old sister was really wanting to go to a club for her birthday, and so I gave her my extra ID, and we went to that club that's up here. I don't know what it's called, Montana West with a bull. And so I snuck her in there, and now I was underage, so I couldn't drink, but I brought a bottle with me. And on the way back, this girl was in my front seat, and she was, you know, really sick. So I started speeding, and then I got pulled over, and they were like, how old are you? And I said, 19. They said, have you been drinking? And I said, yes, because you're not supposed to lie to cops. And so I got my first DUI, and my parents were really excited about that because my 16-year-old sister was in the car with me. Happy birthday, Sarah. Anyway, and I really actually felt that I was going to clean my act up after that. I decided to start going to church again. My entire room was full of, like, neon signs and stuff for, like, all this beer stuff, and I took them down and I put up crucifixes. It didn't help. I started drinking again, and I ended up getting my second DUI. And it was just a Tuesday night, and I had decided not to go out. Now, by this time, the last, like, year and a half of my drinking, I didn't have many friends call me to, like, go and hang out anyway, because I was that person that, like, everybody had to babysit, you know? And so you couldn't bring me because you had to babysit, and then you had to drive me home, because I wasn't allowed to sleep in anybody's house because I would pee their couch, you know? So no one called me, and I really didn't go out. That whole last 18 months of my drinking, I worked and I drank. And so I was a workaholic and an alcoholic. I would work like 95 hours a week. That way I could say, well, I work hard and I play hard, you know, or, well, I'm working as much, so I really can't have a problem, you know, because I would always show up. I mean, I would show up and be drunk for the first half of my shift and then kind of get out of it and eat something and then, like, the rest of the night just be, like, excited about what I was going to drink later. So, and then I'd go home and get drunk and then do it all over again. Well, I'd go home, get drunk, pee the bed, flip the bed over, and then go to work. So by the time I came home, everything was dry. For my year anniversary, I bought myself a new bed. I didn't want to do it before that because I didn't know if I was going to stay sober and waste all that money. But it's still clean. Anyway, so the last 18 months of my drinking, they were really lonely. And, you know, I never knew how to describe that to people, but I figured that I didn't have to because everybody that comes here knows what I'm talking about. And it wasn't until a few months ago that I was reading a big book, and it says something in there, and that it described perfectly how I felt. It says that there's a loneliness that so few know. And that's where I was. I was in that loneliness. And so the last time I drank, and it was a Tuesday night. I was just sitting at my house watching Friends, and then I pulled out my mom's bottle of wine, and then I pulled out my mom's other bottle of wine, and then I called up some friends and said, hey, you want to come over? Okay, bring something. And then they came, and then they brought something, and then I don't even know how much I drank, but I told them that I was going to bed. Never listen to me, because I never go to bed, you know, and instead I got in the car to go get cigarettes, and on the way I got pulled over, and that was my last drunk. And so I woke up in the jail cell, and I was hysterical. I didn't want to call my parents to come pick me up again, but the cops didn't want to keep me there, so they made me. And I got home, and my mom said, you're either leaving or you're going to rehab. And I was like, I can do rehab. So that day I called up Living Grin, and that's where I went. I didn't want to go into rehab, actually. I didn't even want to stop drinking. Because everything that happened to me, like all the feelings and all the consequences, I didn't realize it was as a result of my drinking. I just thought I was depressed. Or I thought it was my family. Or I thought it was because my friends didn't want to be around me. Or because I was working too much or whatever. But I didn't think it was the drinking at all. And I went in there, and they gave me a big book. And I, you know, when I got sober, I was really awkward. Like, I was like an awkward 12-year-old, you know, and so, like, put me in a room with a whole bunch of people that were already friends in there, like, I just sat in the corner with this book, and I didn't even know what it was, and so I started reading it, and I got to some page, and it said something to me that really related to me, and that's when I decided that I was going to, you know, start paying attention, and it was the part where it starts talking about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know, because that was me. And like, okay, maybe there's something to this. I'll kind of listen. And then I met friends in there, and then I had to leave. you know? And I was only in there for like 12 days before my insurance company kindly kicked me out. And I was crying when my mom picked me up because I didn't want to leave. I don't know if I was crying because I was scared, or I don't know if I was crying just because I didn't want to leave rehab, like with my friends. I had made like a bunch of friends in there, and we all exchanged numbers, and you're all going to be sober and happy forever and go around and speak for each other. And which is actually, you know, when I was in there, they said, look to your left, look to your right, that person's not going to be there in a year. That was about 3.5 years ago, and there's still 10 of us that are still sober, and we still meet up, and we still do speaking engagements for each other, and, you know, go to the roundup, which really is amazing, because that's a big number, I feel. But, anyway, so, I left rehab, and I went home, and they told me to go to a meeting your first night, so I went to the 8 o'clock, Expect a Miracle Friday night beginners meeting. And my cousin came with me for support, and I walked in there, and I sat down, and, like, the room was full of people, and I had 17 days, and seemed like at the end of the meeting, the speaker was, or the chairperson was like, if there's anybody that really needs to share before we leave, this is your time. And I felt like he was, like, staring at me, so I got my hand up. And I was like, hi, I'm Trish, and I'm an alcoholic. And then, like, I just started crying, and I'm not a big crier. So this was really embarrassing for me and really awkward for me. And after the meeting, you know, like, a bunch of women came up to me and, you know, hugged me and shook my hand. I was like, oh, my God, you crazy people, get the hell away from me. Like, I didn't know what this was about. So anyway, they told me to go to a meeting the next day, and I did. And I went to this meeting in North Wales, and it seemed like everything they talked about was God. And I didn't sign up for that, so I left. I had some people before I came into AA warn me that AA brainwashes you. So when I went to that meeting, and they were all talking about God, I was like, oh, yeah, no, these people are their brainwashers, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it, so I left. And I didn't go to a meeting for 2 weeks after that. And you know what? The last 18 months of my drinking, I thought that was going to be the worst that I ever could possibly feel in my life. And that wasn't true. That 2 weeks that I just wasn't going to meetings and I was just sitting in my house, that was the worst I had ever felt in my life, both in my addiction and in sobriety. Because I was just as lonely, because when I got out of rehab, I changed my phone number and I deleted all the phone numbers out of my phone. And, I had so much wreckage with my family, and that's who I was living with, that it felt like I was walking on eggshells. You know, it was just really uncomfortable. I was feeling like all these things that I didn't know and that were new and that were really uncomfortable. And at least when I was drinking, I had a bottle. You know what I mean? Like, to kind of mask that for like an hour or 15 minutes or for however long that would last. And now it was like I had nothing. I heard some woman say that, you know, you were star craving sober. So I guess that's what that means. But, anyway, it was 2 weeks to the day after I had gone to that meeting in North Wales, and I was at my house, and I really wanted to drink, and I don't know why I didn't. I think when I was in rehab, they told me that I never had to drink again, and I didn't really care because it wasn't the drinking that I was worried about. And then my counselor said, well, you never have to feel this way again, and that's kind of what caught me. So that's really what I think like kind of kept me from drinking that 2 weeks. And I went outside of my house, and I was smoking a cigarette, and it was like midnight, and I had nothing else to do, and I just dropped to my knees, and I said, God help me, I can't do this anymore, which is strange, because I had left that meeting, because I didn't want to hear about God. 2 weeks later, now I'm praying for him, asking for help, and the next day, I got a call from a girl that I was in rehab with, and she was in a recovery house up in Levittown. And she asked me how, well, she said that she was doing great and that she loved sobriety and it was so much fun. And then she asked me how I was doing. And I was honest with her and I said that I'm not doing so well. I don't think this is for me. I don't think I can do it. And she was like, okay, let me call you back. And she called me back and she said, I can get you into my recovery house if you want to come up. And so, so I went up there. And most of the girls that were in that recovery house either had no place to go or they were just getting out of jail, you know? And so I kind of felt funny having gone there right to my parents' house. You know, like I didn't have to be there, you know. In hindsight, I did have to be there. But that was exactly what I needed, because in Lansdale, everybody was really old and I'm 20, and you're telling me that on a Friday night I'm going to have to call up this 6-year-old woman and be like, hey, you want to hang out? You know, like, that's not happening. So I moved out to Levittown, and there was a whole bunch of really young people, and they were all trying to get sober, and they were all trying to do the same thing that I wanted to do. So that's really what worked out for me. I lived in a house, and these women, they called you out on everything, you know, which then I thought that you were supposed to call people out on stuff. So in the beginning, when they talked about honesty, like, I would call you out and I would tell you exactly what I thought about you, your face, and they'd get all hurt and make it sound disturbing. You know, because I thought that that's what that meant. That's what the girls in my house did. I have a very nicer way of doing that now. But anyway, so living in this house, I had to get a home group in the first 30 days. I had to get a sponsor within the first 30 days, and I had to get a commitment within the first 30 days. So I found a home group because it was the same one that all the other girls were at. I didn't know what a commitment was, so I just pretended that I had one. And I had to get a sponsor. And I found one. And then we go to the house meeting, and they're like, so, did you get one? I said, yeah. And they said, who is it? And I said, Timmy Mac. And they were like, Timmy? Did he say yes? And I was like, oh, well, I didn't ask him. He just did. And they were like, no, you have to go and ask a woman, like, face-to-face, and, you know, she should have at least a year and had been through the steps. So I went to this meeting, and they were talking about when you should have known you were an alcoholic, which is when I had raised my hand and said, well, I should have known I was an alcoholic when I started peeing the bed at 17, you know, which is when that girl said that thing to me. And then this woman got her hand up, and she said, well, I haven't peed the bed in 14 years. And I said, oh, you're my sponsor. You know, because we have the same. They said, get the one that you have me in common with. So I did. But yeah, so I got her to be my sponsor. And it wasn't because she, like, knew the steps so well, or because she lived right, or because she, like, knew everything in the big book. Because I didn't know what any of that stuff was. You know, like, I really didn't know what the steps were. They were just this, you know, stuff on the wall. I didn't know what the big book was, besides reading, like, that first, like, whatever in rehab, which I really didn't even pay attention to. Like, I had no idea what anything was. You know, but she could laugh. And she could have a good time. And she wasn't awkward around people, and that's how I was. And when I got sober, I really thought I was never going to have fun again. I thought that life was, like, over. And this woman told me that she didn't get sober to be miserable. And so neither did I. And that's really why I picked her to be my sponsor. And I stayed there for about 6 months. And then I moved home. Oh, about 5 months, maybe. And then I moved home. And all the girls in my house said that I shouldn't move home. I should stay there for like a year and a half and get a stable footing. And I think they just wanted my money, you know, to like live in there for a year and a half. But I went home anyway because I was living with 11 other women, and there was always drama going on, you know, and I almost looked at it as, like, how much can I really start looking at myself if I'm always dealing with all this drama, you know? So, like, I stayed there until, like, I felt comfortable, and then I went home, and I was going to just continue this journey that I had began. But I moved home, and I went to a meeting at Expect a Miracle, and they were all still old, and I didn't like them, so I just stopped going again, and I didn't go to any meetings for 2 months. I moved home when I had 6 months sober, and that's really when I should have been going to meetings. I turned 21 when I had 6 months, and my mom threw me, like, this big barbecue. And I just, I hated the world. I didn't want to be around anybody that day because it just reminded me that everybody else could and I couldn't. Because by the time I was like 14, I had already planned out my 21st birthday and what it was going to be like, and now I couldn't do it, you know? So instead I sat on the desk with my sponsor and drank a smoothie. Which looking back now, it was pretty neat, but at the time it was not. I actually only started going back to meetings because a friend of mine relapsed. And I realized that because I wasn't going to meetings, he wasn't going to meetings. So if I went to meetings, he would go to meetings. So I drove his ass back to meetings. And he didn't stay sober. And I kept coming back. And I really didn't even have like a firm support network in Lansdale. It was like I had put so much time and energy into Levittown and into making this like recovery network that when I moved away, I didn't want to do all that work again. You know what I mean? So I just kind of went to some meetings and then went home and ate ice cream and watched Friends. And that's really like what my first year of sobriety was. I ate a pint of ice cream every night and I watched Friends because I had bought that complete series. And that's what kept me sober. So when people nowadays say like, I'm early sobriety and I'm not having fun, like, what did you do? Well, buy some ice cream and then go home and watch TV because that's what I did, you know? And, you know, if I had maybe had like a little more guts or a little more like willingness or something, I probably would have made those friendships that people talk about, you know, but I just didn't. And, you know, which is now why when I sponsor people, I kind of really push the suggestion to start calling people early on and build that support network because I didn't. So now when I'm in those situations where I feel like I want to drink, it's so much harder for me to pick up the phone now because I wasn't used to doing it in early sobriety. But, so that's my words of wisdom for the day. Anyway, so I started going back to meetings and then I got a year. And when I got a year, actually, I really didn't know many people at the Lansdale Clubhouse. And somehow they all knew my name. And my mom showed up, my sister showed up, my boss showed up, my sponsor drove down, girls from my house drove down, and they all saw me get my coin. And like in the beginning, I didn't even know if I was going to get a couple days. And I started getting a couple days, and then like I didn't think I was going to get like a month. And then I got a month, and then I got a couple months. And like it just started rolling, you know. So by the time I got a year, I was like, oh my God, you know, like it was a shock, is what it was, because I didn't have any faith that that would happen, because I didn't even come in here to try to get sober, you know what I mean? Anyway, so after I got a year, I actually and everybody congratulated me, and then they all started just to know my name. I felt a little more comfortable there, and I was felt a part of, you know, because people would call me by name, which is huge. So now when I meet people, I try to remember their name. That way when I see them again, I can call them by name, you know, so that they feel just as welcome as I did, you know. But anyway, so I got a year, and I still had my sponsor up in Levittown, and so I really wasn't doing, like, a whole bunch of meeting her or step work or anything, but we had kind of gone through the steps while I was up there. And she didn't go through the steps with the big book. I didn't know that they were in there. We just, I guess, kind of talked about it, and then she'd be like, okay, we now read the step book, and I was like, okay, and I don't even know how it happened, but now when I read the big book, it was like all those same things that happened, like, in the big book that they're talking about, like, the different feelings that you feel and kind of what you go through, that's exactly what happened. So I don't feel like there's, like, just, you know, one in particular way. That way just happened to work for me. But then when I had 2 years, I started reading the big book, and I, you know, should have been meeting. I was like, oh, my God, do you know this stuff is in here? It says, now you are at step three. This is what you do. And I was like, why don't people just do that? You know, like, just use the big book. And so that's kind of what I do now. But I honestly didn't know that in the beginning. I ended up having two women ask me to sponsor them when I got a year. And I said no, because, you know, like, I didn't even know what I was doing in my sobriety. You know, like, I hadn't really had a firm foot in AA meetings. I really wasn't a part of. When I got sober, my sponsor told me that I have to get in the middle of AA or else I'm going to fall off the edge. And I said, okay, I can do that. But I didn't know what that was, and I never asked any questions. So I just thought I was, you know. Today, because I keep coming back to meetings, I know that it's that triangle that you know, we're in a lot of places, service, unity, and recovery. And service is, you know, service, and unity is the fellowship, and recovery is the steps. And I have, if I have, like, a part of that in my life, if I have parts of all that in my life, then I'm in the middle of AA. And I actually feel like I'm a part of it, and I feel like I'm contributing. But in the beginning, I actually was falling off the edge, and I didn't even know it. And so these women asked me to sponsor them, and I said no, because I didn't even know what I was doing. And I had some people tell me that I'm not supposed to do that, I'm supposed to say yes, because you always say yes in AA. And I was like, oh, okay. So I said yes then, and, you know, I should not have been sponsoring anybody. But they told me to, so I did. the thing that happened was I didn't really know what I was doing, and I wasn't talking to my sponsor all that often anyway, because she was living so far away that whenever other people would give me some advice to give to them, like, that's what I would do. So, you know, there's like a million people in AA, and if you're getting a million suggestions, and I'm giving them all to these two girls, like, they're doing like a million and one things, you know, and it's just not consistent. My aunt, she actually just celebrated a year recently, and she told me when she had 3 months that if you've never, I'll say this really quietly for the children, but if you've never met an asshole in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. And so, you know, I was giving them all these asshole suggestions, you know, and both of them relapsed. And then it was my fault. And I decided that I was never going to sponsor anybody ever again because I made these girls drink. And I really took responsibility for that. It wasn't until a while later that I ended up going my first roundup when I had like, a year or two sober. And this guy said, what makes you think that you're that powerful that you can make someone drink? And what makes you think that you're that powerful that you can keep somebody sober? You know, and that's really when that kind of hit me. But I still didn't know what I was doing in my own sobriety. So I realized that's really what I had to be doing. That's, I think, the best thing that came out of that whole situation was me realizing how little I knew in this program and how little I was doing in this program, you know, more importantly. Because I don't even think that it's what you know in here. Like, I think it's what you do. You know, like, you can know all the quotes in the big book and in all the literature, and, you know, you could know everything, but, like, it's what you're doing that counts, you know? So, and I wasn't doing either. So, I started reading the big book, and I started going to more meetings, and I started talking to people, and I started putting my hand out, and I started meeting women, because before that I really only talked to men, and things kind of started to change. They started to change pretty quickly. I had stopped with my 9-step. You know, like, I had kind of gone through that with my sponsor, but I didn't make any amends, because I didn't think I had to, because I was staying sober. So, when I had about 2 years, I almost drank, and I ran to a meeting, and I started crying, and I said, I think I'm going to drink, I don't know what's going on, and I said, keep coming back, and I went to a meeting every day that week, and every meeting was about 7, 8, and 9, you know, like, God gives you exactly what you need, so I realized that I kind of had to start doing 8 and 9, you know, and my first amends was to my mom, which, I brought her out to a restaurant, and that probably wasn't the best idea because I cried the entire time, you know, and but it was a really good experience, and she told me that she was proud of me, and the entire time that I was sober, I really wasn't sure if she was, you know, and then the next amends I made was to my sister, and I cried, and I brought her out to a restaurant. I should learn for the first time because I cried the entire time with that, too. But then I started making these amends, you know, and I started feeling better, and then I started to feel like I know what these promises mean. You know, and then I felt like I was doing something again. It seems like the more action I do in sobriety, the better I feel, and the more like I feel like I'm working for it, you know? Because before I was just showing up, and I really wasn't, I mean, I was staying sober, but like I really wasn't getting much out of that, you know? It says somewhere in the big book that, you know, not drinking is but a beginning. You know, there's a lot more to this thing. And then it says, like, action and more action. And because I wasn't reading the big book for the first 2 years, I didn't know that. And no one told me. So, anyway, I have a bunch of sponsees right now. And I've definitely learned from that. And I give them my experience and my strength and my hope. And I leave my opinion and my advice out of it, which is not what I did the first time. You know, it seems like through my mistakes in sobriety, that's really how I've learned the best. You know what I mean? And they say that if you learn from your mistakes, that's smart, but if you learn from others, then that's wise or something. I'm like, I'm not so wise. I always have to make my own mistakes. And then hopefully I learn from them. Not always. Sometimes it's like the third or fourth mistake, and then I get that feeling in my gut that I know I'm doing something wrong. And then when that pain is too much, you know, like, then I'll start to change things. I don't change things just because. I change it when things are getting too painful. But anyway, so I oh my goodness, I don't know how you guys expect me to speak for an hour. You know what? I was told that that if you find that, like, if you have God in one hand and AA in the other, then there's no hand to pick up a drink. And when I came into sobriety, I had a bunch of girls in my recovery house that they knew all about God, and they had these great relationships with Him, and I just didn't. And so therefore, I felt like I couldn't get this thing. And now I know today that I can't compare myself to other people, and I just have to compare myself to myself. You know, and in the beginning, it was like I had like this much willingness. You know, and I kind of had that the entire time. And, you know, because I keep doing the things that I'm supposed to do and that are suggested to me, that stuff has grown. You know, but, like, that's my biggest fault in sobriety is that I always compare myself to other people. And I never compare myself to myself. So therefore, I always feel like I'm either better than you, which is not good for my ego, or I feel like I'm less than you. And then I feel like I don't belong. You know what I mean? Like, in the beginning, I really didn't think I belonged here because every meeting that I went to was a speaker meeting, and they were all talking about, you know, how they, like I said, they lived under bridges and stuff. And because I didn't do that, like, I didn't belong, you know? So it's really important for me to compare myself to myself. And it's funny how I got the God thing in my life because it's through those mistakes that I was talking about. What I didn't mention was that when I first got sober, I said no relationships in the first year. So I got one in rehab. And you know what? Not the best idea, and I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, but that's really one of the reasons why I'm still sober, you know, because it was that kid that relapsed that helped me get back to meeting. It's amazing how God works, but I try not to say that much at meetings, because then I think that people feel like it's okay to go and meet people in rehab, you know, but anyway, it was through all those mistakes that I made in sobriety, and then realizing that I got through them, it really kind of, made me realize that I had a God in my life. I showed up at a meeting on a Friday night sometime. It was like a 10 o'clock meeting. And there was only three of us there. And so it was supposed to be a topic meeting. I don't know how you have a topic meeting with three people. We each shared for like 20 minutes. So instead we turned into a speaker meeting. We shared for 15 minutes. And this guy shared and this woman shared. And then I shared my story. And it was all about like the mistakes that I made in sobriety, which I kind of told you guys all about. You know, like the relationship with early sobriety and then not going to meetings in the beginning and then moving back and not going to meetings again and, you know, going through the steps in some kind of funky way. And, you know, and afterwards this woman said, you know, wow, God has really been working in your life the entire time. I was like, what are you talking about? And she was like, well, you probably shouldn't be sober right now by the choices that you made and the actions that you did, you know, throughout your sobriety. And I never thought about it. And it was right when that woman said that that I realized how much God had been playing a part in my life. You know what I mean? Like, I just have to keep showing up because I never know when someone's going to be there with something for me to say. You know what I mean? But, you know, I was told that when you start to black out, that means that there's nothing else to say, you know, and then you're just forcing stuff. So Brian actually threatened to punch me if I ended early, but I think that it's better. So thanks for letting me share, everybody.
I did threaten to punch her. If she ended before 8:45, and it's 8:44 right now. All right. I am going to close the meeting, though. The group would like to thank Trish for sharing her experience with us tonight.